Bueno, muchas gracias. Buenos días, compañeros. En la mañana de hoy vamos a dedicar la sesión a discutir acerca del tópico Perspectiva Mundial de Malcolm X, que va a ser desarrollado en las exposiciones de Bill Sales, Osvaldo Cárdenas y Aquinielli Umoya. Yo voy a empezar por darle la palabra al colega Bill Sales, que nos va a hablar acerca de Malcolm X, el contexto mundial en los años 60. Los expositores tendrán 20 minutos para hacer sus presentaciones y luego haremos un receso para dar paso a la discusión, los comentarios, las preguntas y, en general, el debate. Sin más, entonces, le doy la palabra a Bill.
Thank you, Raphael. Brothers and sisters, it's my privilege to be here this morning to participate in a retrospective which is a necessary precondition for charting a future toward the liberation of all oppressed peoples wherever they might be on the globe. Here this morning to participate in a retrospective which is a necessary precondition for charting a future toward the liberation of all oppressed peoples wherever they might be on the globe. Malcolm X is one of the two preeminent leadership figures in the African-American social upheaval of the 1950s and 60s. While still in the Nation of Islam, he pushed the development of the civil rights movement forward while yet standing apart and outside of it. The nationalism of the Nation of Islam. Slower. Oh, the mic is up. Oh, it's dead. Okay. Okay. Can you hear me now? That's better. Okay. Malcolm X is one of two preeminent leadership figures in the African American social upheaval of the 1950s and 60s. While still in the Nation of Islam, he pushed the development of the civil rights movement forward, while yet standing apart and outside of it. The nationalism of the Nation of Islam represented a scathing critique of the established civil rights movement, although it provided little or no guide to anti-racist activism. When that movement entered its period of crisis between 1963 and 1965, Malcolm X broke with the Nation of Islam so that he could not only expand his critique of the civil rights movement, but also actively join it in an effort to effect its qualitative transformation from a domestically oriented mobilization focused on civil rights to a movement for human rights with a recognized international personality. He contributed to this transformation by restoring a secular, political, revolutionary nationalism to the previously assimilationist, integrationist-oriented movement. Moreover, in the last 11 months of Malcolm's life, he reestablished in that revolutionary nationalism the traditional place of preeminence reserved for Pan-Africanism. This paper will focus on the crucial role that Pan-African and anti-imperialist forces played in assisting Malcolm in making the transition from the religious nationalism of the Nation of Islam to the political internationalism of his final statements. Just a few words about the crisis situation in the movement in the 1963-65 period. The dilemmas associated with making tactical and strategic choices between programs of reform or revolution assumed major proportions in the civil rights movement in the period 1963-65. In that period, the civil rights movement was finding it difficult to affect crucial internal changes related to the institutionalization of formal movement organizations, to the transformation of a regional movement into a truly national one, and to the integration of previously inactive classes and social strata into the ongoing mobilization. In the wake of notable successes, the movement was threatened with disillusion because it found it difficult to make hard tactical and strategic choices between programs of reform or revolution. It confronted a dilemma characteristic of this stage in a movement's development. Reform strategies may limit the ability to broaden the mobilization as leadership and middle class elements are co-opted, while revolutionary strategies invite repression. This dilemma had to be confronted at a time when critical changes were taking place in several crucial variables affecting the African-American social mobilization. Among these were the fact that political opportunities had changed with the emergence of the white backlash, the Vietnam War, and nationwide social movements like the Student Power Movement. Organizational strength was impacted upon dramatically by the growth in leadership and geographic diffusion within the movement. Consensus among organizations was lost as the major civil rights leaders disagreed over whether regular access to power had been achieved. Urban inhabitants rebelled violently against ghetto conditions, and the federal government implemented plans to discredit the movement and its more radical leadership. In this same period, the black nationalism of Malcolm X emerged as the major alternative to Dr. King's nonviolent direct action philosophy. Upon his break with the Nation of Islam, Malcolm was able to reformulate the secular political nationalism, which is deeply embedded in the African-American radical tradition. Because of Malcolm X and the social forces which thrust him into leadership, Afro-American nationalism emerged as a major ideological force in the civil rights movement. Afro-American nationalism offered a plan of action to transcend the dilemma of co-optation or repression, which was associated with the tactical and strategic choices between programs of reform or revolution. Malcolm begins his sojourn with several qualitatively distinct interventions in this crisis period. First, while still in the Nation of Islam, Malcolm develops, on the one hand, a scathing critique of the established civil rights movement, and on the other hand, he extracts the rational kernel of Afro-American nationalism from the millenarian messianism of the Nation of Islam. In criticizing the civil rights leadership, Malcolm focused on three crucial aspects of that movement: ideology, leadership, and organization. At the level of ideology, Malcolm indicts the civil rights movement as suffering from false consciousness, as defining the goals and objectives of the movement as the integration of black people into the American system. The civil rights movement projects no fundamental critique of American society, and it erred by restricting its definition of the problem as one of civil rights and their achievement through nonviolent direct action. Thus defined as a domestic concern of the United States, African Americans are constrained to view themselves as an isolated minority, ultimately dependent on the goodwill of those who have oppressed them. It refused to acknowledge the peoplehood of the African American, preferring instead to emphasize those attributes which confirm its Americanness, So conceived, the movement of African Americans was isolated from the broad sweep of change that was convulsing the world, ending white world supremacy and ushering in the era of Afro-Asian hegemony. In addition, the exclusive focus, Malcolm felt, on nonviolence as a guiding philosophy of the movement removed from serious consideration other tactics and strategies which had proved effective in nullifying the overwhelming military technological might of the imperialists. This desire to integrate with the fundamentally faulted and wicked system, Malcolm argued, flowed from the nature of civil rights leadership. This leadership was in the tradition of the House Negro of slavery days. Its political frame of reference was defined by the needs and desires of the master, and its cultural values were those of the master's culture. The middle-class civil rights leadership, by following in the nonviolent assimilationist tradition of its House Negro forebears, had embarrassed the race and sold out the masses of black people. Malcolm's critique continues. He felt that organizationally, the civil rights movement had created no real space within it for urban working poor and lumpen' street leadership, and it did not adequately represent those interests. It had created no organizational forms for collective self-defense. Just as significant, the assimilationist middle-class leadership had made no attempt to forge strong organizational links with pan-Africanist and anti-imperialist forces in the international arena. This, then, is Malcolm's critique of the civil rights leadership and movement in the period of crisis. Late in 1963 and into the spring of 1964, before leaving for Africa, Malcolm rediscovers the African-American secular tradition of political nationalism. At the level of ideology, Malcolm X defines the African-American nationalist tradition as a revolutionary one, a violent struggle for land and self-determination. He sees African-American nationalism as an integral part of the worldwide revolution of Afro-Asians against white domination. As early as his message to the grassroots speech, given before his suspension from the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X essentially saw black nationalism in international perspective. I'll quote him briefly. He, the white man, knows that the black revolution is worldwide in scope and in nature. The black revolution is sweeping Asia, is sweeping Africa, is rearing its head in Latin America. All the revolutions that are going on in Asia and Africa today are based on what? Black nationalism. A revolutionary is a black nationalist. He wants a nation, end quote. In this speech, Malcolm attacked the concept of a nonviolent revolution as a phenomenon not confirmed by the facts of contemporary history. After reviewing the various anti-colonial uprisings, Malcolm X said, and I quote again, "I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you that you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn-the-other-cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution," end quote. For Malcolm X, black nationalism was the natural political expression of the field nigger tradition in African-American political culture. This field nigger tradition is predicated on a profound hatred of the slave master and all his works. As well, it is oriented to the destruction of slavery by any means necessary. In no way does it identify with the values of the slaveholder, valuing only those things which contribute to the destruction of the slave master and his hated institution. The resurrection of the field nigger mentality in the contemporary Negro of Malcolm's day required a psychological rapprochement with Africa. From this identification of African-American nationalism as a natural political expression of the masses of dispossessed urban African Americans. Malcolm asserts that the only valid movement leadership is that which is indigenous to and therefore able to establish rapport with the black urban working classes and the urban street people. On the other hand, legitimate leadership in the black community had to have established credentials in international forums and the respect of third world leadership. Later, on the question of leadership, Malcolm, under the influence of revolutionary thinking in Africa and the third world, moves away from a messianic conception of leadership to one more grounded in the collective equality typical of the revolutionary cadre organizations in the liberation movements. From Cairo in July and August of 1964, Malcolm wrote home to his associates not to confer upon him any special preeminent role in organizational decision making. One of his most important tasks was to establish collective democratic decision making in the OAAU and reverse the legacy of authoritarian leadership carried over from the Nation of Islam period. Upon leaving the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X averred that the basic principle of nationalist organization was that black people had to control the institutions and leadership in their communities. At that time, he felt this could be achieved under the rubric of black economic nationalism and the pursuit of power in the electoral arena through independent black political institutions. As a result of his two trips to Africa in 1964, however, Malcolm X developed a better understanding of the impossibility of the coexistence of black control of black communities in a monopoly capitalist economy rooted in Western imperialism. His growing appreciation of capitalism as a bloodsucker forced upon him an appreciation of the limits of black economic nationalism. It was in this sense that by January of 1965, Malcolm X felt that black nationalism no longer accurately describes his thinking. It was not that he had ceased to be a nationalist, but that his nationalism had distanced itself even more from the reactionary aspects of black economic nationalism, which he had inherited from the Nation of Islam. Malcolm X was a revolutionary nationalist to the end, but a growing appreciation of imperialism ever more rooted Malcolm's thought in an anti-imperialist, internationalist, pan-African perspective. This perspective identified the first order of business as establishing an African-American liberation movement, and as well giving serious consideration to organizational forms which would facilitate collective self-defense up to and including guerrilla warfare if necessary. In addition, it sensitized Malcolm to the need to seriously explore an alternative to capitalism. He looked closely and favorably on African nationalist attempts to create an African socialism. At his death, however, he had not established clearly what kind of socialism should supersede capitalism. There is no available information that Malcolm X had affirmed a commitment to scientific socialism or communism. By 1965, however, he had certainly shed any previous anti-communism that might have been attributed to him from his Nation of Islam period. His intervention in the civil rights movement most certainly cleared the way for the emergence of the serious study of Marxism-Leninism, which appeared in our movement in the latter 60s and early 70s in organizations like the Black Panther Party, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and the African Liberation Support Committee. While still in the Nation of Islam, Malcolm already articulated a strategy of possibly indicting the United States for violation of the human rights of African Americans under international law. The attractiveness of the possibility of mobilizing internationally based forces to check the domestic racism of the United States was to push Malcolm's thought and action increasingly into the international arena, while at the same time affecting significant modifications in that thought. The OAAU represents the broadening of Malcolm X's commitments to black nationalism and the rooting of its internationalist perspectives firmly and explicitly within the Pan-Africanist tradition. First, the OAAU put the image of Africa at the center of African-American attention. For Malcolm, this was necessary for the emotional and cultural rehabilitation of the Afro-American psyche, a precondition so necessary for the desired unity. The political ideology of Malcolm X placed the highest value on the achievement of black unity. To him, black unity would be the primary means by which black people would achieve liberation. However, Malcolm felt that racial unity required, in part, a reconstructed image of African-American culture. To understand Malcolm's reconstruction requires an explicit treatment of the impact of class on African-American culture and an essentially political conception of the African-American's cultural heritage. Through the analysis of the house nigger, field nigger dialectic, Malcolm not only exposed the social, historical, and cultural origins and slavery of the contemporary debate between integration and nationalism, but its class character as well. This political role that Malcolm assigned to Afro-American culture is not viable unless the class character of the main cultural trends in the black community is identified. For Malcolm, then, the significance of any cultural trend in the black community was a function of its impact on the struggle for black liberation. The Afro-American conception of Africa was the centerpiece of the cultural renaissance Malcolm desired. By the time of his return from his summer and fall 64 trips to Africa, Malcolm X was to see the essence of the sense of a need for separatism, not in a mere physical return to Africa, but in a strengthened commitment to African redemption. His November 1964 statement is that of a historically orthodox black nationalist, but in the best Pan-African tradition. At that time he said, and I quote briefly, "It is only with a strong Africa, an independent Africa, and a respected Africa that wherever those of African origin or African heritage or African linkages go, they will be respected." In this context, Malcolm makes his final clarification on the question of separatism. And Malcolm said, now paraphrasing, that his position was that we did not have to pack our bags and get ready to take a boat back to Africa. There were no large number of African Americans, Malcolm felt, who were prepared to do that, and he didn't feel it was necessary. But what is necessary, is, he said, is that we have to go back mentally, we have to go back culturally, we have to go back spiritually and philosophically and psychologically. And when we go back in that sense, the spiritual bond that is created makes us inseparable. And therefore, we can see that our problem is their problem, and that their problem is our problem, and that there will be no mutual solution of the problems confronting us both without inseparable cooperation and unity. The role of Africa in the thinking of Malcolm X is essentially political. The advocacy of a cultural identification with Africa is not advanced as an end in itself. It is a means by which African Americans could reclaim their psyche and their self-respect in order to fight back against racism and exploitation. Malcolm X visualized the OAAU as the organizational vehicle for internationalizing the struggle of the African American. Such an internationalization of the civil rights struggle, he felt, was absolutely essential if it were to have any chance of success. As he put it, and I quote, "I would like to impress upon every Afro-American leader that there's no kind of action in this country that is ever going to bear fruit unless that action is tied in with the overall international struggle," end quote. Internationalization would, in his view, transmute the African-American minority status in white America into majority status within the worldwide majority of Afro-Asian people. Organizationally and politically, Malcolm saw the United Nations and the Bandung Third World Bloc as a counterweight to the domestic political power of the United States. Internationalizing the struggle meant to transform the struggle for civil rights into a struggle for human rights. The advantage here is that the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the Genocide Convention unequivocally affirm the paramountcy of human rights, whereas domestic U.S. law was still an imperfect guarantor of the civil rights of Afro-Americans. If successful, Malcolm felt, the internationalization of the struggle of Afro-Americans would give blacks breathing room in relationship to the power of racism in the United States due to the fear of world opinion. Such breathing room could be used to organize for self-defense, aggressive electoral politics, and black economic advancement. Malcolm X repeatedly returns to the theme of self-defense because he truly believed that African Americans would have to fight their oppressors because, as he said, violence is the only language they understand. And African Americans needed allies internationally, especially in Africa, if they would have to exercise the option of self-defense. Malcolm X feared the intentions of American white people, but in the OAAU period, Malcolm goes to great lengths to establish a material basis for his animosity toward whites. This he had to do because some of the most nationalistic and radical regimes on the continent were also the most anti-racist. He would not have been taken seriously by the likes of Nyerere and Nkrumah if he had not repudiated the Nation of Islam's devil theory of whites or any veil equivalents of it. The OAAU as a united front was patterned upon and reflected the structure of the mass-based nationalist parties which led countries like Ghana, Guinea, Tanzania, and Kenya, among others, to independence. The OAAU concept also reflected the impact that revolutionary organizations in the Portuguese colonies in southern Africa and the Algerian and Cuban revolutionary experience had on Malcolm. On a more practical level, the OAAU would facilitate the granting of UN observer status to Malcolm X's organizational efforts and make it easier for Malcolm to address his international audience as a legitimate representative of a national liberation movement. The idea of internationalizing the struggle, however, raised problems of establishing the legitimacy of the Afro-American struggle for human rights as a subject of international law and organization. The quest for legitimacy mandated at a minimum that African Americans speak to international bodies with one voice. Malcolm X knew that if the alternative of the bullet ever had to be resorted to in international forums, unity of African Americans and African people organized in the OAAU and the OAU would be a necessary prerequisite. On the other hand, efficacious participation of black people in electoral politics in the United States would depend on internationally supervised guarantees of the fundamental human rights of black people. These guarantees required that African Americans be capable organizationally of presenting their demands in an international capacity. This certainly was not the situation within the civil rights movement in the 1963-65 period, and for Malcolm X, the quickest way to establish such unanimity was not to challenge the established civil rights leadership, but to form a united front with them within the context of the OAAU. Reflecting the impact of his spring 1964 trip to Africa and the discussions there with a host of nationalist and revolutionary anti-imperialist third world leadership, Malcolm affected considerable modification in his approach to the Afro-American middle class and to segments of the white community. And if I could just take maybe a few more minutes, I'll conclude. And I promise that it won't be another half hour. Okay, a few minutes. Thank you. In his message to the grassroots speech, Malcolm X expressed the opinion that the question of violence would separate the black community along class lines. He saw the black middle class at that time as being defined by those who ate the thought and attitudes of the white man. Malcolm called this group after slave era nomenclature house niggers. The black middle class, he felt, was a class with a house nigger mentality, most epitomized by their fear of revolutionary violence. The black middle class was at the root of the Uncle Tom civil rights leadership that was selling out the masses of black people. Implied here by Malcolm in his early 1964 period was that in a revolutionary situation, the black middle class had to be written off. However, by the spring of 64, Malcolm X had moved away from this perception of the black middle class and its potential for revolution. And he said, one of the troubles of the black nationalists is that they have held themselves apart. Since I've gotten involved, I am surprised at how militant some of these integrationists are sounding. Man, sometimes they put me to shame. Malcolm's analysis of the black middle class by this time was a little bit more complex. He said the black middle class in its attempt to protect the crumbs the white man gives while trying at the same time to deceive him is the most acrobatic of Negroes. We have to revolutionize his thinking. He will come around when he realizes that he is barking up the wrong tree. Malcolm to the end retained a fundamental suspicion of white intentions. He felt the one glaring weakness of civil rights leadership was their acquiescence in the usurpation of leadership functions in black civil rights organizations by white liberals. This interfered with the process of dialogue so necessary to construct black unity and the Black United Front. This he assigned the highest priority. Nevertheless, as early as the spring of 64, Malcolm X recognized a role for progressive whites in his movement for human rights. For the rest of his life, his perception of that role evolved. He was especially impressed by the potential for white youth to break away from the racist strictures and behavior of their parents' generation. This newly emerging force, he argued, could be an important ally of the African-American people in their struggle for human rights. His more differentiated view of white revolutionary potential by his own attribution was significantly influenced by revolutionary activists he encountered on his two trips to Africa and the Middle East in 1964, and as well by the impact young white student activists were having on him as he encountered them at home. In summary, let me simply say that Malcolm X stood the test of time as a thinker and critic of the black intellectual radical tradition. It is through Malcolm that the black liberation movement was taught many of the principles undergirding revolutionary movements throughout the Third World. We have previously made reference to the important transition that Malcolm represents between King's Gandhi and nonviolence and the redemptive violence of Fanon. Malcolm X is just as directly linked to the salient thought of an Amilcar Cabral or even a Mao Zedong. In his thought and in his living example, Malcolm told no lies and claimed no easy victories. He was a thinker with a scientific outlook who neither retreated from calling a spade, nor avoided the necessity of giving precedence to the struggle against our own weaknesses. Most importantly, through Malcolm, more and more ordinary black people are able to transcend the particularity of their oppression and to begin to visualize their day-to-day struggles as a local particular aspect of the more international struggle for human rights, a revolutionary movement that is essentially a struggle for power. Thank you.